mountains, out of sight, so to speak. Let him come, Sparhawk said bleakly. We stopped him 500 years ago, and we can do it again if we have to. Vanyan shook his head. We don't want a repetition of what happened after the battle at Lake Rendera, a century of famine, pestilence, and complete social collapse. No, my friend, that we don't want. If we can avoid it, Sophronia added. I am Styric, and I know even better than you Alines just how totally evil the Elder God Azash is. If he comes west again, he must be stopped, no matter what the cost. That's what the Church Knights are here for, Vanyan said. Right now, about all we can do is keep our eyes on Otha. I've just remembered something, Sparhawk said. When I was riding into town last night, I saw Krager. Here in Samura? Vanyan asked, sounding surprised. Do you think Martell could be with him? Probably not. Krager's usually Martell's errand boy. Addis is the one who has to be kept on a short chain. He squinted. How much did you hear about the incident in Cypria? He asked them. We heard that Martell attacked you, Vanyan replied. That's about all. There was a bit more to it than that, Sparhawk told him. When Aldria sent me to Cypria, I was supposed to report to the Alenian consul there, a diplomat who just happens to be the cousin of the primate Aeneas. Late one night, he summoned me. I was on my way to his house when Martell, Addis, and Krager, along with a fair number of local cutthroats, came charging out of a side street. There's no way that they could have known that I'd be passing that way unless someone had told them. Put that together with the fact that Krager's back in Samura, where there's a price on his head, and you start to come up with some interesting conclusions. You think that Martell is working for Aeneas? It's a possibility, wouldn't you say? Aeneas wasn't very happy about the way my father forced Aldrius to give up the notion of marrying his own sister, and it's entirely possible that he felt that he'd have a freer hand here in Alenia if the family of Sparhawk became extinct in a back alley in Cypria. Of course, Martell has his own reasons for disliking me. I really think you made a mistake, Vanyan. You could have saved us all a lot of trouble if you hadn't ordered me to withdraw my challenge. Vanyan shook his head. No, Sparhawk, he said. Martell had been a brother in our order, and I didn't want you two trying to kill each other. Besides, I couldn't be entirely sure who'd win. Martell is very dangerous. So am I. I'm not taking any unnecessary chances with you, Sparhawk. You're too valuable. Well, it's too late to worry about it now. What are your plans? I'm supposed to stay here in the chapter house, but I think I'll drift around the city a bit and see if I can run across Krager again. If I can connect him with anybody who's working for Aeneas, I'll be able to answer a few burning questions.
Perhaps you should wait a bit, Sophronia advised. Calton's on his way back from Lamarkand.
Calton? I haven't seen him in years.
She's right, Sparhawk, Vanyan agreed. Calton's a good man in tight corners, and the streets of Samura can be just as dangerous as the alleys of Cypria.
When's he likely to arrive?
Vanyan shrugged. Soon, I think. It could even be today.
I'll wait until he gets here. An idea came to Sparhawk then. He smiled at his teacher and rose to his feet.
What are you doing, Sparhawk? She asked him suspiciously.
Oh, nothing, he replied. He began to speak in Styric, weaving his fingers in the air in front of him as he did so. When he had built the spell, he released it and held out his hand. There came a humming vibration, followed by a dimming of the candles and a lowering of the flames in the fireplace. When the light came up again, he was holding a bouquet of violets. For you, little mother, he said, bowing slightly and offering the flowers to her. Because I love you.
Why, thank you, Sparhawk, she smiled, taking them. You were always the most thoughtful of my pupils. You mispronounced Staratha, though,
she added critically. You came very close to filling your hand with snakes.
I'll practice, he promised.
Do.
There was a respectful knock at the door.
Yes, Vanyan called. The door opened and one of the young knights stepped inside.
There's a messenger from the palace outside, Lord Vanyan. He says that he has been commanded to speak with Sir Sparhawk.
Now what do they want? Sparhawk muttered.
You'd better send him in, Vanyan told the young knight. At once, my lord.
The knight bowed slightly and went out again.
The messenger had a familiar face. His blonde hair was still elegantly curled. His saffron-colored doublet, lavender hose, maroon shoes, and apple-green cloak still clashed horribly. The young fop's face, however, sported an entirely new embellishment. The very tip of his pointed nose was adorned with a large and extremely painful-looking boil. He was trying without much success to conceal the excrescence with a lace-trimmed handkerchief. He bowed elegantly to Vanyan.
My lord preceptor, he said, the prince regent sends his compliments.
And please convey mine back to him, Vanyan replied.
Be assured that I shall, my lord.
The elegant fellow then turned to Sparhawk.
My message is for you, Sir Knight, he declared.
Say on, then. Sparhawk answered with exaggerated formality. My ears hunger for your message.
The fop ignored that. He removed a sheet of parchment from inside his doublet and read grandly from it.
By royal decree, you are commanded by His Highness to journey straight away to the mother house of the Pandian Knights at Deimos, there to devote yourself to your religious duties until such time as he sees fit to summon you once again to the palace.
I see, Sparhawk replied.
Do you understand the message, Sir Sparhawk? The fop asked, handing over the parchment.
Sparhawk did not bother to read the document. It was quite clear. You have completed your mission in a fashion which does you credit.
Sparhawk peered at the perfumed young fellow.
If you don't mind some advice, neighbor, you ought to have that boil looked at by a surgeon. If it isn't lanced soon, it's going to keep growing to the point where you won't be able to see around it.
The fop winced at the word lanced.
Do you really think so, Sir Sparhawk? He asked plaintively, lowering his handkerchief. Wouldn't a poultice, perhaps?
Sparhawk shook his head. No, neighbor, he said with false sympathy. I can almost guarantee you that a poultice won't work. Be brave, my man. Lancing is the only solution.
The courtier's face grew melancholy. He bowed and left the room.
Did you do that to him, Sparhawk?
Sifreni asked suspiciously.
Me?
He gave her a look of wide-eyed innocence.
Somebody did. That eruption is not natural.
My, my, he said. Imagine that.
Well? Vanyan said. Are you going to obey the bastard's orders?
Of course not, Sparhawk snorted. I've got too many things to do here in Samira.
You'll make him very angry.
So?
Chapter 4 The sky had turned threatening again when Sparhawk emerged from the chapter house and clanked down the stairs into the courtyard. The novice came from the stable door leading Farron, and Sparhawk looked thoughtfully at him. He was perhaps 18, and quite tall. He had knobby wrists that stuck out of an earth-colored tunic that was too small for him.
"What's your name, young man?" Sparhawk asked him.
"Barrett, my lord."
"What are your duties here?"
"I haven't been assigned anything specific as yet, my lord. I just try to make myself useful."
"Good. Turn around."
"My lord?"
"I want to measure you."
Barrett looked puzzled, but he did as he was told. Sparhawk measured him across the shoulders with his hands. Although he looked bony, Barrett was actually a husky youth.
"You'll do fine," Sparhawk told him.
Barrett turned, baffled. You're going to be making a trip, Sparhawk told him. Gather up what you'll need while I go get the man who's going to go with you.
Yes, my lord, Barrett replied, bowing respectfully.
Sparhawk took hold of the saddle bow and hauled himself up onto Farron's back. Barrett handed him the reins, and Sparhawk nudged the big roan into a walk. They crossed the courtyard, and Sparhawk responded to the salutes of the knights at the gate. Then he rode on across the drawbridge and through the east gate of the city. The streets of Samura were busy now. Workmen carrying large bundles wrapped in mud-colored burlap grunted their way through the narrow lanes, and merchants, dressed in conventional blue, stood in the doorways of their shops with their brightly colored wares piled around them. An occasional wagon clattered along the cobblestones. Near the intersection of two narrow streets, a squad of church soldiers in their scarlet livery marched with a certain arrogant precision. Sparhawk did not give way to them, but instead bore down on them at a steady trot. Grudgingly, they separated and stood aside as he passed. Thank you, neighbors, Sparhawk said pleasantly. They did not answer him. He reined Farron in. I said, thank you, neighbors. You're welcome, one of them replied sullenly. Sparhawk waited. My lord, the soldier added grudgingly. Much better, friend. Sparhawk rode on. The gate to the inn was closed, and Sparhawk leaned over and banged on its timbers with his gauntleted fist. The porter who swung it open for him was not the same knight who admitted him the evening before. Sparhawk swung down from Farron's back and handed him the reins.
Will you be needing him again, my lord? The knight asked.
Yes, I'll be going right back out. Would you saddle my squire's horse, Sir Knight?
Of course, my lord.
I appreciate that. Sparhawk laid one hand on Farron's neck. Behave yourself, he said. Farron looked away, his expression lofty. Sparhawk clinked up the stairs and rapped on the door of the room at the top. Curic opened the door for him.
Well, how did it go?
Not bad.
You came out alive anyway. Did you see the queen?
Yes, that's surprising.
I sort of insisted. Do you want to get your things together? You're going back to Deimos. You didn't say we, Sparhawk.
I'm staying here.
I suppose there are good reasons.
Lycius has ordered me back to the Mother House. I more or less plan to ignore him, but I want to be able to move around Samura without being followed. There's a young novice at the chapter house who's about my size. We'll put him in my armor and mount him on Farron. Then the two of you can ride to Deimos with a grand show of obedience. As long as he keeps his visor down, the primate spies will think I'm obeying orders.
It's workable, I suppose. I don't like the idea of leaving you here alone, though.
I won't be alone. Calton's coming in either today or tomorrow.
That's a little better. Calton's steady.
Curic frowned.
I thought that he'd been exiled to Lamorkind. Who ordered him back?
Vanyan didn't say, but you know Calton. Maybe he just got bored with Lamorkind and took independent action.
How long do you want me to stay at Deimos? Curic asked as he began to gather up his things.
A month or so at least. The road's likely to be watched. I'll get word to you. Do you need any money?
I always need money, Sparhawk.
There's some in the pocket of that tunic. Sparhawk pointed at his travel clothes draped across the back of a chair. Take what you need.
Curic grinned at him.
Leave me a little, though.
Of course, my lord,
Curic said with a mocking bow.
Do you want me to pack up your things?
No, I'll be coming back here when Calton arrives. It's a little hard to get in and out of the chapter house without being seen. Is the back door to that tavern still open?
It was yesterday. I drop in there from time to time.
I thought you might.
A man needs a few vices, Sparhawk. It gives him something to repent when he goes to chapel.
If Aslaid hears that you've been drinking, she'll set fire to your beard. Then we'll just have to make sure that she doesn't hear about it, won't we, my lord? Why do I always get mixed up in your domestic affairs? It keeps your feet planted in reality. Get your own wife, Sparhawk. Then other women won't feel obliged to take special note of you. A married man is safe. A bachelor is a constant challenge to any woman alive. About a half an hour later, Sparhawk and his squire went down the stairs into the courtyard, mounted their horses, and rode out through the gate. They clattered along the cobblestone streets towards the east gate of the city. "We're being watched, you know," Keurig said quietly. "I certainly hope so," Sparhawk replied. "I'd hate to have to ride around in circles until we attract somebody's attention." They went through the ritual again at the drawbridge of the chapter house and then rode on into the courtyard. Barrett was waiting for them. "This is Keurig," Sparhawk told him as he dismounted. "The two of you will be going to Deimos. Keurig, the young man's name is Barrett." The squire looked the acolyte up and down. "He's the right size," he noted. "I might have to shorten a few straps, but your armor should come close to fitting him." "I thought so myself." Another novice came out and took their reins. "Come along then, you two," Sparhawk said. "Let's go and tell Vanyan what we're going to do, and then we'll put my armor on our masquerader here." Barrett looked startled. "You're being promoted, Barrett," Keurig told him. "You see how quickly one can move up in the Pandians? Yesterday a novice, today Queen's Champion." "I'll explain it to you when we see Vanyan," Sparhawk told Barrett. "It's not so interesting a story that I want to go over it more than once." It was mid-afternoon when the three of them emerged from the chapter house door again. Barrett walked awkwardly in the unaccustomed armor, and Sparhawk was dressed in a plain tunic and hose. "I think it's going to rain," Keurig said, squinting at the sky. "You won't melt," Sparhawk told him. "I'm not worried about that," the squire replied. "It's just that I'll have to scour the rust off your armor again. Life is hard." Keurig grunted, and then the two of them boosted Barrett up into Farron's saddle. "You're going to take this young man to Deimos," Sparhawk told his horse. "Try to behave as if it were me on your back." Farron gave him an inquiring look. "It would take much too long to explain. It's entirely up to you, Farron, but he's wearing my armor, so if you try to bite him, you'll probably break your teeth." Sparhawk turned to his squire. "Say hello to Aslaid and the boys from me," he said. "Right," Keurig nodded. Then he swung up into his saddle. "Don't make too big a show when you leave," Sparhawk added. "But make sure that you're seen, and make sure that Barrett keeps his visor down." "I know what I'm doing, Sparhawk. Come along then, my lord," Keurig said to Barrett.
"My lord?"
"You might as well get used to it, Barrett." Keurig pulled his horse around. "I'll see you, Sparhawk." Then the two of them rode out of the courtyard towards the drawbridge. The rest of the day passed quietly. Sparhawk sat in the cell which Vanyan had assigned to him, reading a musty old book. At sundown, he joined the other brothers in the refectory for the simple evening meal, then marched in quiet procession with them to chapel. Sparhawk's religious convictions were not profound, but there was again that sense of renewal involved in the return to the practices of his novitiate. Vanyan conducted the services that evening and spoke at some length on the virtue of humility. In keeping with his long-standing practice, Sparhawk fell into a doze about halfway through the sermon. He was awakened at the end of the sermon by the voice of an angel. A young knight with hair the color of butter and a neck like a marble column lifted his clear tenor voice in a hymn of praise. His face shone and his eyes were filled with adoration.
"Was I really all that boring?" Vanyan murmured, falling in beside Sparhawk as they left the chapel.
"Probably not," Sparhawk replied, "but I'm not really in any position to judge. Did you do the one about the simple daisy being as beautiful in the eyes of God as the rose?"
"You've heard it before."
"Frequently. The old ones are the best."
"Who's your tenor?"
"Sir Parasim,"
He just won his spurs. I don't want to alarm you, Vanyan, but he's too good for this world. I know. God will probably call him home very soon. That's God's business, isn't it, Sparhawk? Do me a favor, Vanyan. Don't put me in a situation where I'm the one who gets him killed. That's also God's business. Sleep well, Sparhawk. You too, Vanyan. It was probably about midnight when the door to Sparhawk's cell banged open. He rolled quickly out of his narrow cot and came to his feet with his sword in his hand. Don't do that, the big, blonde-haired man in the doorway said in disgust. He was holding a candle in one hand and a wineskin in the other. Hello, Calton, Sparhawk greeted his boyhood friend. When did you get in? About a half hour ago. I thought I was going to have to scale the walls there for a while. He looked disgusted. It's peacetime. Why do they raise the drawbridge every night? Probably out of habit. Are you going to put that down? Calton asked, pointing at the sword in Sparhawk's hand. Or am I going to have to drink this whole thing by myself? Sorry, Sparhawk said. He leaned his plain sword against the wall. Calton set his candle on the small table in the corner, tossed the wineskin onto Sparhawk's bed, and then caught his friend in a huge bear hug. It's good to see you, he declared. And you too, Sparhawk replied. Have a seat. He pointed at the stool by the table and sat down on the edge of his cot. How was Lamerkind? Calton made an indelicate sound. Cold, damp, and nervous, he replied. Lamerks are not my favorite people in the world. How was Rendor? Sparhawk shrugged. Hot, dry, and probably just as nervous as Lamerkind. I heard a rumor that you ran into Martell down there. Did you give him a nice funeral? He got away. You're slipping, Sparhawk. Calton unfastened the collar of his cloak. A great mat of curly blonde hair protruded out of the neck of his mail coat. Are you going to sit on that wineskin all night? He asked pointedly. Sparhawk grunted, unstoppered the skin, and lifted it to his lips. Not bad, he said. Where did you get it? He handed the skin to his friend. I picked it up in a wayside tavern about sundown, he replied. I remembered that all there is to drink in Pandian chapter houses is water, or tea, if Sophrenia happens to be around. Stupid custom. We are a religious order, Calton. There are a half dozen patriarchs in Krellos who get drunk as lords every night. Calton lifted the wineskin and took a long drink. Then he shook the skin. I should have picked up too, he observed. Oh, by the way, Kirik was in the tavern with some young puppy wearing your armor. I should have guessed that, Sparhawk said wryly. Anyway, Kirik told me that you were here. I was going to spend the night there, but when I heard that you'd come back from Rendor, I rode on the rest of the way. I'm touched. Calton laughed and handed back the wineskin. Were Kirik and the novice staying out of sight? Sparhawk asked. Calton nodded. They were in one of the back rooms, and the young fellow was keeping his visor down. Have you ever seen anybody trying to drink through his visor? Funniest thing I ever saw. There were a couple of local whores there, too. Your young Pandian might be getting a education along about now. He's due, Sparhawk observed. I wonder if he'll try to do that with his visor down as well. Those girls are usually adaptable. Calton laughed. Anyhow, Kirik told me about the situation here. Do you really believe you can sneak around Samira without being recognized? I was thinking along the lines of a disguise of some sort. Better come up with a false nose, Calton advised. That broken beak of yours makes you fairly easy to pick out of a crowd. You should know, Sparhawk said. You're the one who broke it. We were only playing, Calton said, sounding a bit defensive. I've got used to it. We'll talk to Sophrenia in the morning. She should be able to come up with something in the way of disguises. I'd heard that she was here. How is she? The same. Sophrenia never changes. Truly. Calton took another drink from the wineskin and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. You know,
I think I was always a big disappointment to her. No matter how hard she tried to teach me the secrets, I just couldn't master the Styric language. Every time I tried to say Ogera Gekasik, I almost dislocated my jaw.
Ogera Gukasik, Sparhawk corrected him.
However you say it, I'll just stick to my sword and let others play with magic.
He leaned forward on his stool.
They say that the Ashandis are on the rise again in Rendor. Is there any truth to that?
It's no particular danger, Sparhawk shrugged, lounging back on his cot.
They howl and spin around in circles out in the desert and recite slogans to each other.
That's about as far as it goes. Is anything very interesting going on in Lamerkind?
Kalten snorted.
All the barons there are involved in private wars with each other, he reported.
The whole kingdom reeks with the lust for revenge. Would you believe that there's actually a war going on over a bee sting? An earl got stung and declared war on the baron whose peasants owned the hive. They've been fighting each other for 10 years now.
That's Lamerkind for you.
Anything else happening?
The whole countryside east of Matera is crawling with Zemox.
Sparhawk sat up quickly.
Vanyan did say that Otha was mobilizing.
Otha mobilizes every 10 years.
Kalten handed his friend the wineskin.
I think he does it just to keep his people from getting restless.
Are the Zemox doing anything significant in Lamerkind?
Not that I was able to tell. They're asking a lot of questions, mostly about old folklore. You can find 2 or 3 of them in almost every village. They question old women and buy drinks for the loafers in the village taverns.
Peculiar, Sparhawk murmured.
That's a fairly accurate description of just about anybody from Zemok, Kalten said. Sanity has never been particularly prized there.
He stood up.
I'll go find a bed someplace, he said. I can drag it in here and we can talk old times until we both fall asleep.
All right.
Kalten grinned. Like the time your father caught us in that plum tree.
Sparhawk winced.
I've been trying to forget about that for almost 30 years now.
Your father did have a very firm hand, as I recall.
I lost track of most of the rest of that day, and the plums gave me a bellyache besides. I'll be right back.
He turned and went out the door of Sparhawk's cell. It was good to have Kalten back. The two of them had grown up together in the house of Sparhawk's parents at Deimos, after Kalten's family had been killed, and before the pair of boys had entered their novitiate training at the Pandian Motherhouse. In many ways, they were closer than brothers. To be sure, Kalten had some rough edges to him, but their close friendship was one of the things Sparhawk valued more than anything. After a short time, the big blonde man returned, dragging a bed behind him. And then the two of them lay in the dim candlelight, reminiscing until quite late. All in all, it was a very good night. Early the following morning, they rose and dressed themselves, covering their mail coats with the hooded robes Pandians wore when they were inside their chapter houses. They rather carefully avoided the morning procession to chapel, and went in search of the woman who had trained whole generations of Pandian knights in the intricacies of what were called the secrets. They found her seated with her morning tea before the fire high up in the south tower.
Good morning, little mother. Sparhawk greeted her from the doorway. Do you mind if we join you?
Not at all, Sir Knights.
Kalten went to her, knelt, and kissed both her palms.
Will you bless me, little mother? He asked her.
She smiled and put one hand on each side of his face. Then she spoke her benediction in Styric.
That always makes me feel better for some reason, he said, rising to his feet again. Even though I don't understand all the words.
She looked at them critically.
I see that you chose not to attend chapel this morning.
God won't miss us all that much, Kalten shrugged. Besides, I could recite all the Vanyan sermons from memory.
What other mischief are you two planning for today? She asked.
Mischief, Sophronia? Kalten asked innocently.
Sparhawk laughed. Actually, we weren't even contemplating any mischief. We just have a fairly simple errand in mind.
Out in the city?
He nodded. The only problem is that we're both fairly well known here in Samura. We thought you might be able to help us with some disguises. She looked at them, her expression cool.
I'm getting a strong sense of subterfuge in all this.
Just exactly what is this errand of yours?
We thought we'd look up an old friend, Sparhawk replied. A fellow named Krager. He has some information he might want to share with us.
Information? He knows where Martell is.
Krager won't tell you that.
Calton cracked his big knuckles, the sound unpleasantly calling to mind the sharp noise of breaking bones.
Would you care to phrase that in form of a wager, Sophronia? He asked.
Won't you two ever grow up? You're a pair of eternal children.
That's why you love us so much, isn't it, little mother?
Calton grinned.
What sort of disguise would you recommend? Sparhawk asked her.
She pursed her lips and looked at them.
A courtier and his squire, I think.
No one could ever mistake me for a courtier, he objected.
I was thinking of it the other way around. I can make you look almost like a good honest squire. And once we dress Calton in a satin doublet and curl that long blonde hair of his, he can pass for a courtier.
I do look good in satin, Calton murmured modestly. Why not just a couple of common workmen? Sparhawk asked.
She shook her head.
Common workmen cringe and fawn when they encounter a nobleman. Could either of you manage a cringe?
She's got a point, Calton said.
Besides, workmen don't carry swords, and I don't imagine that either of you would care to go into Samura unarmed.
She thinks of everything, doesn't she? Sparhawk observed.
All right, she said. Let's see what we can do.
Several acolytes were sent scurrying to various places in the chapter house for a number of articles. Sophronia considered each one of them, selecting some and discarding others. What emerged after about an hour were two men who only faintly resembled the pair of Pandians who had first entered the room. Sparhawk now wore a plain livery, not unlike Curix, and he carried a short sword. A fierce black beard was glued to his face, and a purple scar ran across his broken nose and up under a black patch that covered his left eye.
This thing itches, he complained, reaching up to scratch at the false beard.
Keep your fingers off of it until the glue dries, she told him, lightly slapping his knuckles, and put on a glove to cover that ring.
Do you actually expect me to carry this toy? Calton demanded, flourishing a light rapier. I want a sword, not a knitting needle.
Courtiers don't carry broadswords, Calton, she reminded him.
She looked at him critically. His doublet was bright blue, gored and inset with red satin. His hose matched the goring and he wore soft half-boots, since no pair of the pointed shoes currently in fashion could be found to fit his huge feet. His cape was of pale pink, and his freshly curled blonde hair spilled down over the collar. He also wore a broad-brimmed hat adorned with a white plume.
You look beautiful, Calton, she complimented him. I think you might pass, once I rouge your cheeks.
Absolutely not!
He backed away from her.
Calton, she said quite firmly, sit down.
She pointed at a chair and reached for a rouge pot.
Do I have to?
Yes. Now sit.
Calton looked at Sparhawk.
If you laugh, we're going to fight, so don't even think about it.
Me? Since the chapter house was watched at all times by the agents of the primate Annius, Vanyan came up with a suggestion that was part subterfuge and part utilitarian.
I need to transfer some things to the inn anyway, he explained. Annius knows that the inn belongs to us, so we're not giving anything away. We'll hide Calton in the wagon bed and turn this good, honest fellow into a teamster.
He looked pointedly at the patch-eyed, bearded Sparhawk.
Where on earth did you find so close a match to his red hair? He asked Sophronia curiously. She smiled. The next time you go into the stables, don't look too closely at your horse's tail.
My horse?
He was the only black horse in the stable, Vanyan, and I didn't take all that much, really.
My horse? He repeated, looking injured.
We must all make sacrifices now and then, she told him. It's a part of the Pandian Oath, remember?
Chapter 5 The wagon was rickety, and the horse was spavined. Sparhawk slouched on the wagon seat with the reins held negligently in one hand, and apparently paying very little attention to the people in the street around him. The wheels wobbled and creaked as the wagon jolted over a rutted place in the stone-paved street.
Sparhawk, do you have to hit every single bump?
Calton's muffled voice came from under the boxes and bales loosely piled around him in the back of the wagon.
Keep quiet, Sparhawk muttered. Two church soldiers are coming this way.
Calton grumbled a few choice oaths, then fell silent. The church soldiers wore red livery and disdainful expressions. As they walked through the crowded streets, the workmen and blue-clad merchants stepped aside for them. Sparhawk reined in his nag, stopping the wagon in the exact center of the street so that the soldiers would be forced to go around him.
Morning, neighbors, he greeted them.
They glared at him, then walked on around the wagon.
Have a pleasant day, he called after them.
They ignored him.
What was that all about?
Calton demanded in a low voice from the wagon bed.
Just checking my disguise, Sparhawk replied, shaking the reins.
Well? Well what? Does it work?
They didn't give me a second glance.
How much farther to the end? I'm suffocating under all this.
Not too much farther.
Give me a big surprise, Sparhawk. Miss a bump or two, just for the sake of variety.
The wagon creaked on. At the barred gate of the inn, Sparhawk climbed down from the wagon and pounded the rhythmic signal on its stout timbers. After a moment, the night porter opened the gate. He looked at Sparhawk carefully.
Sorry, friend, he said. The inn's all full.
We won't be staying, Sir Knight, Sparhawk told him. We just brought a load of supplies from the chapter house.
The porter's eyes widened, and he peered more closely at the big man.
Is that you, Sir Sparhawk?
He asked incredulously.
I didn't even recognize you.
That was sort of the idea. You aren't supposed to.
The knight pushed the gate open, and Sparhawk led the weary horse into the courtyard.
You can get out now, he said to Calton as the porter closed the gate.
Help get all this off me.
Sparhawk moved a few of the boxes, and Calton came squirming out. The night porter gave the big blonde man an amused look.
Go ahead and say it, Calton said in a belligerent tone.
I wouldn't dream of it, Sir Knight.
Sparhawk took a long, rectangular box out of the wagon bed and hoisted it up onto his shoulder.
Get somebody to help you with these supplies, he told the porter. Preceptor Vanyan sent them, and take care of the horse. He's tired.
Tired? Dead would be closer.
The porter eyed the disconsolate-looking nag.
He's old, that's all. It happens to all of us sooner or later.
Is the back door to the tavern open?
He looked across the courtyard at a deeply inset doorway.
It's always open, Sir Sparhawk.
Sparhawk nodded, and he and Calton crossed the courtyard.
What have you got in the box? Calton asked.
Our swords.
That's clever, but won't they be a little hard to draw?
Not after I throw the box down on the cobblestones, they won't.
He opened the inset door. After you, my lord, he said, bowing. They passed through a cluttered storeroom and came out into a shabby-looking tavern. A century or so of dust clouded the single window, and the straw on the floor was moldy. The room smelled of stale beer and spilled wine and vomit. The low ceiling was draped with cobwebs, and the rough tables and benches were battered and tired-looking. There were only three people in the place, a sour-looking tavern keeper, a drunken man with his head cradled in his arms on a table by the door, and a blousy-looking whore in a red dress dozing in the corner. Calton went to the door and looked out into the street.
It's still a little underpopulated out there, he grunted.
Let's have a tankard or two while we wait for the neighborhood to wake up.
Why not have some breakfast instead?
That's what I said.
They sat at one of the tables, and the tavern keeper came over, giving no hint that he recognized them as Pandians. He made an ineffective swipe at a puddle of spilled beer on the table with a filthy rag.
What would you like?
His voice had a sullen, unfriendly tone.
Beer,
Calton replied.
Bring us a little bread and cheese, too,
Sparhawk added. The tavern keeper grunted and left them.
Where was Krager when you saw him?
Calton asked quietly.
In that square near the west gate.
That's a shabby part of town.
Krager's a shabby sort of person. We could start there, I suppose, but this might take a while.
Krager could be down just about any rat hole in Samura.
Did you have anything else more pressing to do?
The whore in the red dress hauled herself wearily to her feet and shuffled across the straw-covered floor to their table.
I don't suppose either of you fine gentlemen would care for a bit of frolic,
she asked in a bored-sounding voice. One of her front teeth was missing, and her red dress was cut very low in front. Perfunctorily, she leaned forward to offer them a view of her flabby-looking breasts.
It's a bit early, little sister, Sparhawk said. Thanks all the same.
How's business? Calton asked her.
Slow. It's always slow in the morning, she sighed. I don't suppose you could see your way clear to offer a girl something to drink, she asked hopefully.
Why not? Calton replied. Tavern keeper, he called. Bring the lady one too.
Thanks, my lord,
the horse said. She looked around the tavern.
This is a sorry place,
she said with a certain amount of resignation in her voice.
I wouldn't even come in here except that I don't like to work the streets, she sighed. Do you know something?
She said.
My feet hurt. Isn't that a strange thing to happen to someone in my profession? You'd think it would be my back. Thanks again, my lord.
She turned and shuffled back to the table where she had been sitting.
I like talking with whores, Calton said. They've got a nice, uncomplicated view of life.
That's a strange hobby for a church knight.
God hired me as a fighting man, Sparhawk, not as a monk. I fight whenever he tells me to, but the rest of my time is my own.
The tavern keeper brought them tankards of beer and a plate with bread and cheese on it. They sat eating and talking quietly. After about an hour, the tavern had attracted several more customers, sweat-smelling workmen who had slipped away from their chores, and a few of the keepers of the nearby shops. Sparhawk rose, went to the door, and looked out. Although the narrow back street was not exactly teeming with traffic, there were enough people moving back and forth to provide some measure of concealment. Sparhawk returned to the table.
I think it's time to be on our way, my lord, he said to Calton.
He picked up his box.
Right, Calton replied.
He drained his tankard and rose to his feet, swaying slightly and with his hat on the back of his head. He stumbled a few times on the way to the door, and he was reeling just a bit as he led the way out into the street. Sparhawk followed him with the box once again on his shoulder.
Aren't you overdoing that just a little? He muttered to his friend when they turned the corner.
I'm just a typical drunken courtier, Sparhawk. We've just come out of a tavern.
We're well past it now. If you act too drunk, you'll attract attention. I think it's time for a miraculous recovery.
You're taking all the fun out of this, Sparhawk, Calton complained.
He stopped staggering and straightened his white-plumed hat. They moved on through the busy streets with Sparhawk trailing respectfully behind his friend as a good squire would. When they reached another intersection, Sparhawk felt a familiar prickling of his skin. He set down his wooden box and wiped at his brow with the sleeve of his smock.
What's the matter? Calton asked, also stopping.
The case is heavy, my lord, Sparhawk explained in a voice loud enough to be heard by passerby. Then he spoke in a half-whisper.
We're being watched, he said as his eyes swept the sides of the street.
The robed and hooded figure was in an upper-floor window, partially concealed behind a thick, green drape. It looked very much like the one that had watched him in the rain-wet streets the night he had first arrived back in Samura.
Have you located him? Calton asked quietly, making some show of adjusting the collar of his pink cloak. Sparhawk grunted, raising the box to his shoulder again. Upper floor window over the Chandler's shop.
Let's be off then, my man, Calton said in a louder voice. The day's wearing on.
As he started on up the street, he cast a quick, furtive glance at the green-draped window. They rounded another corner.
Odd-looking sort, wasn't he? Calton noted. Most people don't wear hoods when they're indoors.
Maybe he's got something to hide.
Do you think he recognized us?
It's hard to say. I'm not positive, but I think he was the same one who was watching me the night I came into town. I didn't get a good look at him, but I could feel him, and this one feels just about the same.
Would magic penetrate these disguises?
Easily. Magic sees the man, not the clothes. Let's go down a few alleys and see if we can shake him off in case he decides to follow us.
Right.
It was nearly noon when they reached the square near the west gate where Sparhawk had seen Krager. They split up there. Sparhawk went in one direction and Calton the other. They questioned the keepers of the brightly colored booths and the more sedate shops closely, describing Krager in some detail. On the far side of the square, Sparhawk rejoined his friend. Any luck? He asked.
Calton nodded. There's a wine merchant over there who says that a man, who looks like Krager, comes in 3 or 4 times a day to buy a flagon of Arcean Red.
That's Krager's drink, all right, Sparhawk grinned. If Martell finds out that he's drinking again, he'll reach down his throat and pull his heart out.
Can you actually do that to a man?
You can if your arm's long enough, and if you know what you're looking for.
Did your wine merchant give you any sort of hint about which way Krager usually comes from?
Calton nodded. That street there, he pointed. Sparhawk scratched at his horsetail beard, thinking.
If you pull that loose, Sofreni is going to turn you over her knee and paddle you.
Sparhawk took his hand away from his face. Has Krager picked up his first flagon of wine this morning? He asked.
Calton nodded. About 2 hours ago. He's likely to finish that first one fairly fast. If he's drinking the way he used to, he'll wake up in the mornings feeling a bit unwell.
Sparhawk looked around the busy square. Let's go on up that street a ways, where there aren't quite so many people, and wait for him. As soon as he runs out of wine, he'll come out for more.
Won't he see us? He knows us both, you know.
Sparhawk shook his head. He's so short-sighted that he can barely see past the end of his nose. Add a flagon of wine to that, and he wouldn't be able to recognize his own mother.
Krager's got a mother? Calton asked in mock amazement. I thought he just crawled out from under a rotten log.
Sparhawk laughed. Let's go find some place where we can wait for him.
Can we skulk? Calton asked eagerly. I haven't skulked in years.
Skulk away, my friend, Sparhawk said. They walked up the street the wine merchant had indicated. After a few hundred paces, Sparhawk pointed towards the narrow opening of an alley.
That ought to do it, he said. Let's go do our skulking in there. When Krager goes by, we can drag him into the alley and have our little chat in private.
Right, Calton agreed with an evil grin. They crossed the street and entered the alley. Rotting garbage lay heaped along the sides, and some way farther on was a reeking public urinal. Calton waved one hand in front of his face.
Sometimes your decisions leave a lot to be desired, Sparhawk, he said. Couldn't you have picked someplace a little less fragrant?
You know, Sparhawk said, that's what I've missed about not having you around, Calton. That steady stream of complaints.
Calton shrugged. A man needs something to talk about.
He reached under his azure doublet, took out a small, curved knife, and began to strop it on the sole of his boot.
I get him first, he said.
What?
Krager, I get to start on him first.
What gave you that idea?
You're my friend, Sparhawk. Friends always let their friends go first. Doesn't that work the other way around, too?
Calton shook his head.
You like me better than I like you. It's only natural, of course. I'm a lot more likable than you are.
Sparhawk gave him a long look.
That's what friends are for, Sparhawk.
Calton said ingratiatingly, to point out our little shortcomings to us. They waited, watching the street from the mouth of the alley. It was not a particularly busy street, for there were but few shops along its sides. It seemed rather to be given over largely to storehouses and private dwellings. An hour dragged by, and then another.
Maybe he drank himself to sleep, Calton said. Not Krager. He can hold more than a regiment. He'll be along.
Calton thrust his head out of the opening of the alleyway and squinted at the sky.
It's going to rain, he predicted. We've both been rained on before.
Calton plucked at the front of his gaudy doublet and rolled his eyes.
But Sparhawk, he lisped outrageously, you know how Thatton spots when it gets wet.
Sparhawk doubled over with laughter, trying to muffle the sound. They waited once more, and another hour dragged by.
The sun's going to go down before long, Calton said. Maybe he found another wine shop.
Let's wait a little longer, Sparhawk replied. The rush came without warning. 8 or 10 burly fellows in rough clothing came charging down the alley with swords in their hands. Calton's rapier came whistling out of his sheath, even as Sparhawk's hand flashed to the hilt of his short sword. The man leading the charge doubled over and gasped as Calton smoothly ran him through. Sparhawk stepped past his friend as the blond man recovered from his lunge. He parried the sword stroke of one of the attackers and then buried his sword in the man's belly. He wrenched the blade as he jerked it out to make the wound as big as possible.
Get that box open, he shouted at Calton as he parried another stroke.
The alleyway was too narrow for more than two of them to come at him at once. Even though his sword was not as long as theirs, he was able to hold them at bay. Behind him he heard the splintering of wood as Calton kicked the rectangular box apart. Then his friend was at his shoulder with his broadsword in his hand.
I've got it now, Calton said. Get your sword.
Sparhawk spun and ran back to the mouth of the alley. He discarded the short sword, jerked his own weapon out of the wreckage of the box, and whirled back again. Calton had cut down two of the attackers, and he was beating the others back step by step. He did, however, have his left hand pressed tightly to his side, and there was blood coming out from between his fingers. Sparhawk rushed past him, swinging his heavy sword with both hands. He split one fellow's head open and cut the sword arm off another. Then he drove the point of his sword deep into the body of yet a third, sending him reeling against the wall with a fountain of blood gushing from his mouth. The rest of the attackers fled. Sparhawk turned and saw Calton coolly pulling his sword out of the chest of the man with the missing arm.
"Don't leave them behind you like that, Sparhawk," the blonde man said. "Even a one-armed man can stab you in the back. Besides, it isn't tidy. Always finish one job before you go on to the next."
He still had his left hand tightly pressed to his side.
"Are you all right?" Sparhawk asked him.
"It's only a scratch."
Scratches don't bleed like that. Let me have a look.
The gash in Calton's side was sizable, but it did not appear to be too deep. Sparhawk ripped the sleeve off the smock of one of the casualties, wadded it up, and placed it over the cut in Calton's side.
Hold that in place, he said. Push in on it to slow the bleeding.
I've been cut before, Sparhawk. I know what to do. Sparhawk looked around at the crumpled bodies littering the alley.
I think we ought to leave, he said. Somebody in the neighborhood might get curious about all the noise.
Then he frowned. Did you notice anything peculiar about these men? He asked.
Calton shrugged. They were fairly inept.
That's not what I mean. Men who make a living by waylaying people in alleys aren't usually very interested in their personal appearance, and these fellows are all clean-shaven. He rolled over one of the bodies and ripped open the front of his canvas smock.
Isn't that interesting? He observed.
Beneath the smock, the dead man wore a red tunic with an embroidered emblem over the left breast.
Church soldier, Calton grunted. Do you think that Annius might possibly dislike us?
It's not unlikely. Let's get out of here. The survivors might have gone for help.
The chapter house, then? Or the inn?
Sparhawk shook his head. Somebody's seen through our disguises, and Annius would expect us to go to one of those places.
You could be right about that. Any ideas?
I know of a place. It's not too far. Are you all right to walk?
I can go as far as you can. I'm younger, remember?
Only by 6 weeks.
Younger is younger, Sparhawk. Let's not quibble about numbers.
They tucked their broadswords under their belts and walked out of the mouth of the alley. Sparhawk supported his wounded friend as they moved out into the open. The street along which they walked grew progressively shabbier, and they soon entered a maze of interconnecting lanes and unpaved alleys. The buildings were large and run down, and they teemed with roughly dressed people who seemed indifferent to the squalor around them.
"It's a rabbit warren, isn't it?" Calton said. "Is this place much farther? I'm getting a little tired."
"It's just on the other side of that next intersection."
Calton grunted and pressed his hand more tightly to his side. They moved on. The looks directed at them by the inhabitants of this slum were unfriendly, even hostile. Calton's clothing marked him as a member of the ruling class, and these people at the very bottom of society had little use for courtiers and their servants. When they reached the intersection, Sparhawk led his friend up a muddy alley. They had gone about halfway when a thick-bodied man with a rusty pike in his hands stepped out of a doorway to bar their path.
"Where do you think you're going?" he demanded.
"I need to talk to Platum," Sparhawk replied.
"I don't think he wants to hear anything you have to say. If you're smart, you'll get out of this part of town before nightfall. Accidents happen here after dark."
"And sometimes even before dark," Sparhawk said, drawing his sword.
"I can have a dozen men here in 2 winks."
"And my broken-nosed friend here can have your head off in 1, Calton told him.
The man stepped back, his face apprehensive.
"What's it to be, neighbor?" Sparhawk asked. "Do you take us to Platum, or do you and I play for a bit?"
"You've got no right to threaten me."
Sparhawk raised his sword so that the fellow could get a good look at it.
"This gives me all sorts of rights, neighbor.
Lean your pike against that wall and take us to Platum, now."
The thick-bodied man flinched, and then carefully set his pike against the wall, turned, and led them on up the alley. It came to a dead end 100 paces farther on, and a stone stairway ran down to what appeared to be a cellar door.
"Down there," the man said, pointing.
"Lead the way," Sparhawk told him. "I don't want you behind me, friend. You look like the sort who might make errors in judgment."
Sullenly, the fellow went down the mud-coated stairs and rapped twice on the door.
"It's me," he called. "Seth, there are a couple of nobles here who want to talk to Platum."
There was a pause followed by the rattling of a chain. The door opened, and a bearded man thrust his head out.
"Platum doesn't like noblemen," he declared.
"I'll change his mind for him," Sparhawk said. "Step back out of the way, neighbor."
The bearded man looked at the sword in Sparhawk's hand, swallowed hard, and opened the door wider.
"Pass right along, Seth,"
Calton said to their guide. Seth went through the door.
"Join us, friend," Sparhawk told the bearded man when he and Calton were inside. "We like lots of company."
The stairs continued down between moldy stone walls that wept moisture. At the bottom, the stair opened out into a very large cellar with a vaulted stone ceiling. There was a fire burning in a pit in the center of the room, filling the air with smoke, and the walls were lined with roughly constructed cots and straw-filled pallets. 2 dozen or so men and women in a wide variety of garments sat on those cots and pallets, drinking and playing at dice. Just beyond the fire pit, a huge man with a fierce black beard and a vast paunch sprawled in a large chair, with his feet thrust out toward the flames. He wore a satin doublet of a faded orange color, spotted and stained down the front.
and he held a silver tankard in one beefy hand.
"That's Platum," Seth said nervously. "He's a little drunk, so you should be careful, my lords."
"We can deal with it," Sparhawk told him. "Thanks for your help, Seth.
I don't know how we'd have managed without you."
Then he led Calton on around the fire pit.
"Who are all these people?" Calton asked in a low voice, looking around at the men and women lining the walls.